Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit and creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today, as always, we have a very special guest. We have Laura Fasha. Laura has her PhD and is a published author, professional artist, compelling and empowering speaker, and certified trainer. She holds a BA in fine arts, an MA in counseling psychology, and a combined doctorate in clinical and organizational psychology. Laura has a very, very special message, and I've read both of her books. One is coming out, one is already out. It's called The Inward Outlook. That's the one that's already out, and it is a special message that has already changed my life. But I'm not going to give away too much. Now I'm going to bring Laura Fasha to the studio. Am I saying your name right?
Yes, you are.
Okay, good.
Hi, Hillary.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So Laura and I were just in a course together, right? That's really where we got to know each other. And we decided that she is the perfect guest for the Getting Real with Hillary show. So here we are. All right. So Laura, you were telling me your story yesterday, and I think that's important for people to hear. I mean, here you are with a PhD, an MA, you know, you have so much, you're an artist, you publish books, but you know, people might not know where you started. So why don't you tell me the story you were telling yesterday, if you don't mind.
Of my beginnings.
Yes. Your 8-year-old self. Yes.
My 8-year-old self. That's going back a ways. So I wrote this in the book. It's at the beginning and in more detail, but my childhood was difficult. It was actually a nightmare for me and my sisters. And so to reference the age of eight, by the age of eight, I had figured out how to stay out of my parents' way. My father was frightening to be around, and my mother was emotionally very unpredictable. So there was a lot of what we would call abuse. And my sisters and I all sort of got out of the house by the time we were 18. That was also culturally what people did back at that time. What I didn't really appreciate until later was, as a kid, I had learned to read the psychological undercurrents of what was happening. That's how I could stay out of their way. And that's how I learned to survive, really. So it was a developed capacity at a very young age that became refined and sophisticated in my training as I, you know, went on and studied psychology and graduate school. And then, of course, was in the field.
Yeah. So, okay, just going back a little bit, because some people may be able to relate to what was going on in your house. Was it, and I forget what you said yesterday, was it drugs or alcohol with your father? What was the cause?
My dad was a gambler. And he was not an alcoholic, but there was a lot of sugar consumption in the house. And if you know anything about alcoholism, that kind of addiction to sugar is a similar kind of issue. Certainly physiologically in the body, it impacts you. And, you know, I don't blame them I mean, I've done quite a bit of work of forgiveness, and listen, people do the best they can or they would do something else. So given what they were dealing with, and at that time, when they were growing up, and certainly when I was growing up in the 50s, that people weren't doing therapy. People didn't even know about alcoholism in the 50s, maybe just beginning to discover that. So the conversation about addiction and, you know, growth and development was just not in the cultural mindset. Now, that said, it still had quite an impact. I learned to be quiet. I learned to not rock the boat. I learned to, you know, be the perfect kid, not speak my mind. So much of my maturing had to do with getting freed up from the kind of thinking that I had developed as a child, which is it's not safe here, so you better pretty much become invisible and do everything just right.
And so what would happen if you didn't? I mean, I know you learned that. I actually have the same thing that I learned. Be careful. Don't make dad mad. And like, I was good. I never spoke up. You know, I was pretending, but that's what I learned to do. So what would happen? I know what happened if I got my father mad. What would happen if you said the wrong thing or whatever? Would they hit you, just verbally abuse? Like what was it?
It was more from my dad. It was more verbal abuse. He was very sarcastic and insulting, and you know, that's almost worse sometimes than being hit. So it was four girls, and there was a lot of fear, I think, in my parents, so in that household. So I picked up on it's just not safe here. My mother was emotionally unpredictable. So she would get physical and she would just suddenly like lash out and, you know, grab us by the arm and pull us by the hair. I mean, it was, you know, I don't go into detail like this, but it was,
yeah,
you know, I had nightmares until I was into early adulthood. So it impacted me.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Yeah. No, trust me, I get it. I'm not trying to belittle it. I'm just asking in case there's other people out there who have this similar fear, you know, because home is where you're supposed to be safe. And
right.
Yet you had no place where you were safe. So
the happy childhood for the most part is kind of a myth. So now there are people who had happy childhoods. I'm not saying that's not happening, mm-hmm. but in working with people and when we really start to deal with the patterning in ourselves that keeps us from experiencing life the way we would like, or keeps us from accomplishing what we would like to accomplish, or keeps us from being in the relationships we want to be in relationship with. When you actually start to look at that, you really do start to distinguish things, events that took place that, not that you didn't deal with them, but they had an impact in a way that we there's, you know, compartmentalized to deal with it in the past. But as we get older, we have the strength and capacity to start distinguishing these things that we had to lock away for a while and start dealing with them. Mm-hmm. The kind of secret counterintuitive point to this is that it's those issues, when we deal with them, that actually give us the freedom that we're looking for. Because if we don't have a challenge to deal with, you know, why look at anything? If life's kind of copacetic all the time, you know, and if we don't look at those things, we kind of live life on a more shallow level. So there's a depth of awareness and a depth of self-expression and a depth of meaning to life that's available by distinguishing these patterns that are in the way of our authentic self-expression, our authentic intimacy, our authentic capacity to be with people, to be with ourselves.
Yeah. Now, you had said, was it that you didn't sleep until you were 35 years old?
No, I slept, but I had nightmares every night.
Oh, nightmare. Okay.
And that's what sleep was for me.
Wow. Like bad ones, like
nightmares. Nightmares were frightening.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't have them now. No. I haven't had them for decades.
How did you get, I mean, that's a long time to have nightmares, right? That must have been sort of normal, even though it was terrible. But how did you finally get rid of them? Like, what had them stop?
Well, several things happened. I was about 30. I had met my spiritual teacher. I had left the East Coast and moved to California and met the woman who was to become my spiritual teacher for the next 15 years. And I also got into more alternative health practices. So I discovered a homeopath and got some homeopathic remedies. And the combination of those two things, and also in California at that time, which would have been the late 70s, there were all sorts of the human potential movement sort of was burgeoning out here. I'm still in California. And I was participating in workshops that really did help me start to distinguish these kind of patterns that I was just referencing. And the combination of eating better and getting some kind of alternative medication, really, and then going deeper into spiritual understanding of healing. I studied with Catherine Jarvis. The Reverend Catherine Jarvis was her name, and she taught us how to heal. And so, in the process of healing, we worked with an international prayer ministry, and we would get prayer requests from around the world, and we had miracles happen. You know, the doctors were amazed. We got those reports often, and I really got to see that there is so much more available to who we are as humans than we think. We mostly are focused on the third dimension that we walk around in, but there are other dimensions that are intersecting this physical plane. Mm-hmm. And in learning how to access that and learning how to sort of identify with that and not just the internal thought processes, there's a whole expansion available for healing, for well-being, for peace of mind, for all the things that we're looking for.
Wow. So when you said, if you don't mind, when you started healing, you met Catherine Jarvis and you started healing. What, I don't know if you can explain like one thing that you healed or something like, I don't know if you want to say your nightmares or something, you know, from your childhood, the fear. I don't know. Is there anything that you can describe?
Well, it's a lifelong practice. There's no end to getting freed up from certain traumas. I mean, I completed and healed my relationship with both my parents before they died. And it ended in very loving connections. Now, that didn't disappear the childhood patterning that was set years before, but it's an ongoing practice. Let's see, what can I say to that?
So like, what's a pattern that you could, maybe it's not gone, but you're aware of it from childhood? Like, obviously you said you had felt invisible, you didn't speak up, you wanted to be safe, you know, you were very careful. Is that something that you...
Well, let me say it this way.
Okay.
What I was able to distinguish over time, and I first learned this with Catherine Jarvis, how our thinking creates our experience. She used to say, the thought is the thing. And I came to it from a spiritual perspective, which was Christian-based. And what I started to realize was I had been listening, paying attention to the internal thinking that was from my childhood, which basically boils down to, I wasn't good enough and I'm not worth being taken care of. You know, these are very common things. I'm not alone in this kind of assessment. And once I started to see that those were old patterns of thought that actually were not happening anymore, that I wasn't paying attention to what was available to me in the present, I was living out of the stories I had created about what happened to me in the past. I mean, certainly if you're, you know, thrown in the closet and crying inconsolably at 3 years old and not let out, you know, you have, you make that mean something. I must be really bad. I must not be worth even living. And so seeing that I was living out of these stories had me realize, well, what part of me can see that story? Who is that that's watching this story? And I started to see that there's an essence of who I am that's much bigger than the personality that I have become. And I then started, then as time went on, I started understanding through my professional training that humans are thinking machines. The human body is the brain is spewing out thoughts like the heart is beating and the lungs are breathing. It's just what the brain does. Right. But all the thoughts that it spews out are from the past. And the only way the past gets brought to life is by paying attention to it. So what I started to really understand and then eventually practice was there's a lot of freedom in not paying attention to that thinking, but just being really present in this moment, paying attention to what's happening in this moment with no attention to thinking from the past. And what I started to experience was a kind of freedom and well-being. And that contrasted so sharply to when I was thinking about the other thing humans like to be is victims. Because I you know, I want you to know how bad it was for me. So I want you to know how much I have suffered. And we identify with this instead of realizing, yeah, that stuff happened. It wasn't okay. I mean, I think these two people that were my parents had no business having children, but that's the way, that was the deck of cards that was dealt, right? And so that happened, but that is not happening now. Who am I without paying attention to all that? Then new possibilities start to show up. So where I was feeling, we were talking about hopeless, where I was feeling, you know, like I should just be invisible, started disappearing. And I started to experience and value who I really was in the world, with friends, with artwork. Artwork started when I was a kid. It was an escape for me to be drawing and painting. You know, it was a way for me to sort of get out of the fray.
So when you said you got in touch, or I don't remember your words, with the essence as opposed to, you know, the person with the story from the past, how, and, you know, maybe it took 85 years, but I'm not saying you're that old.
I'm not there yet.
No, I'm not saying that at all. Like,
and maybe you can't do it at 85.
But like, how did you? Because I just did a an inquiry on stillness. Like, how do we capture that? You know, how do we stop listening to the brain? It's always going. How do you? I don't know if it's switch or just access essence versus this thing.
It's a great question. It's a great question. It's really an important question. The essence is always available to us. It's equally everywhere present. We're actually looking at each other through it, even on these computers. It's a thought away. It's just that we're so attached and identified with our thought processes that it doesn't occur to us that there's something else. So we have these experiences naturally, like when we're on vacation. If you're a musician and you're in the middle of playing music, you're so present with the music, you forget the rest of your life. Athletes will experience it when they're, you know, at the top of their game. You're just so in the moment with what you're doing that everything else disappears. So it's a practice. So I have a meditation practice. That's the beauty of a meditation practice, is you practice being very quiet, not paying attention to your thoughts when your thoughts come in, because they will, because the brain keeps spewing them in there. You just notice that you're paying attention to your thinking and you stop paying attention. It's that simple. Mm-hmm. But it does take something. And we are so used to really being attached to our thinking that we call it normal. But it's actually where most of our suffering comes from, is paying attention to what happened in the past or what our expectations are for the future, which is also based in the past. The past doesn't exist, nor does the future, because everything that happened in the past actually happened in the present moment. And everything that's supposed to happen in the future will not happen until that moment occurs. So there is no time. There is only now. And in the moment of now, being present with no attention to thinking, the essence or the stillness or God or, you know, everything we're looking for is in that flow of being present in the moment. Infinite intelligence, omniscient wisdom, omnipotent love is available to every one of us. But we're so busy being attached to what we know that we don't take the time to listen for what we don't know. If I'm flummoxed by something or confronted with something, I'll stop and ask myself, what am I not seeing? What am I missing? And then I'll just listen and I'll wait. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the answer comes, you know, when I'm driving the car or I'm in the shower. Some when I'm not really, I kind of put it on the back burner as an inquiry. And then eventually, when I'm quiet enough, my innate wisdom and common sense will occur to me.
So it seems like a lot of it is awareness, being aware that there's something besides our thoughts and just like stopping.
Yes. And listening.
Yeah.
To the quietness within. And everyone has that. Some of us are more attached to thinking than others. There are some people who are so attached to their thinking that really life is about reactivity and worrying, and that's the result of not waking up to this realm of quietness that's available to all of us.
Do you think that they just don't know it's available?
Well, yes. Or it's considered woo-woo. It's discarded. It's discarded. And the reason it's discarded is because the ego, the attachment to our thinking, the attachment toward the identity that we've become, does not want us to connect to essence, because if we connect to essence, it's out of a job, and its job is to survive. Wow. Now, it's great, but you want to use thought as a tool. You want to use time as a tool, but mostly we don't use thought. Thought uses us. Our thinking is running the show. The eternal self, the authentic self, the joyful, wise self is not actually required for most of our life. It's kind of like you get in the car. By the time you've got your license, you're not thinking about how to drive the car anymore. You're just driving the car and you're thinking about something else. That's kind of how we live our life.
So when I was doing... I did a course with someone, and it was a new thing, all about the soul and how our birthright is just what you were talking about, joy, love, you know, passion, you know, that other space, not the thinking, but that other space where we're connected and we're, you know, that infinite intelligence, you know, all that conscious, you know. And I was like, that resonated, that is what our birthright is, not this other thing where we're suffering and we got to be right. And, you know, I got to fight you. And I mean, I had a fight with my admin today and I said, I'm not going to do this. If you keep saying that, I'm going to hang up. And I did. I just wasn't going to, I didn't want to engage. I said, she was saying, well, you did this. I said, you're right. I did it, but that's not the conversation I want to have. Anyway, so I hung up on her and I'm okay with that. I just didn't want to engage in like, who's right? Like, where does that get us? And so, you know,
it strengthens the ego. It strengthens, see, the ego wants to prove that it's superior. So if it's right, it's superior. Even if you're a victim, you get to be a little bit superior, because how else would you distinguish that this shouldn't have happened to you? That you know better than someone.
And
I'm not saying that horrible things don't happen to people. I'm not saying that.
Right.
Or that horrible things don't happen in the world. But the desire to fight, the need to be separate, the need to have an other, is coming from that separate identification with the individuality of my own thinking. Standing in essence, I realize that there's a oneness that connects all of us. And the lack of awareness of that oneness is what has people digging their heels in to be right about their positions and confronting each other. It's the heart of what war is.
So what do we get out of being superior? I mean, I get that's our thrown way and, you know, war and all that. What do we get out of it? Or is it just a power thing?
We get to be right. We get to make other people wrong. And it feeds the ego's need to survive. It's kind of what, you know, it's kind of just how we're designed.
Yeah.
But the opportunity now for humanity is to recognize the usefulness of the ego, but to not be completely identified with it, and to start accessing compassion and understanding, so that we can see that whenever the ego is engaged, whenever someone's trying to be right, whenever someone's starting a fight, they're not only looking to trigger that justification for the suffering they have by having you could jump in. It's It's I just lost where I was going with that.
Yeah, something
so good.
Justifying about jumping in when you're
you justify jumping in, but you also cut yourself off from the truth of yourself, mm-hmm. which is the innate. You cut yourself off from your innate wisdom and your innate intelligence and your innate common sense and the relatedness, the affinity that you actually have with the other person. You'd have to be willing to disappear that you're separate. And that's frightening for people.
It should be the opposite, right? I mean, like, I think being separate is more frightening than being connected. But for some reason, losing that separateness, I guess it's what we know. You know what I'm saying? Like,
well, at a certain point, it's the separateness is more frightening than the relatedness. But that's a shift in consciousness for you to even say that.
Right.
So before that, people kind of have to dig their heels in to prove their point, because that's how they know themselves.
Yeah.
You're so identified with their thinking that to start to realize that it's me over there that I'm talking, it's going to invalidate my sense of self.
Right.
So there's a evolutionary process that gets you to the place that starts getting curious about how another person sees life, not threatened by how another person sees life, but interested, fascinated, knowing that it doesn't mean anything. It's just their thinking.
Hmm. Wow. All right. It's time, believe it or not, for a commercial break, but I'm writing down to get curious about it, because I do want to, in the next part, you know, if people haven't heard of this or this is a new concept for them, like, how do they start getting curious? You know, like that, if that's the first step. So, okay, we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. This is fascinating. Yeah, thank you, Lauren.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. KIKORI.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary Show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to RealTalkWithHillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
Thank you, as always, to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. Okay, Kikori is an experiential social-emotional learning platform.
That's what it is. It's no longer, I was corrected by what I was calling it before. So it's a platform that you can take, as the commercial said, into your schools, into your businesses, into your teams, so that people are more connected. Just what we've been talking about today, more connected, more real. And so you can go to KikoriApp.com and connect with them and ask for a demo. It's the best. My daughter works there, and it really can transform education for our children. And then, as always, my books, if you like being real and you want to hear some courageous tales, my first book is a great read. It's called The Second Piece of French Toast. If Marriage Was My Dream, Why Was I Numbing Myself? And yes, I was numbing myself. I didn't know it. But after I kind of got to the other side, as we've been talking about with Laura, I decided to write the story in case there were other people that found themselves stuck in a life that they didn't know how they had gotten there, and they didn't particularly like it. So I wrote it so that I could inspire others. I also have this book, Real Talk. One of my issues was that, like Laura, I don't know if it's exactly like Laura, but I was a pretending, people-pleasing phony who didn't speak up. When I started to, I realized the freedom in it, that I could get past my limiting thinking, as we've been talking about, and how to get free. So this has a getting real process, which can help you start saying the things you're afraid to say so that you can have the life you've always wanted, but were afraid you couldn't have. So anyway, that's Real Talk. You can go to that's my email, Hillary@gettingrealwithhillary.com, or go to the website realtalkwithhillary.com. You can get the book, you can see the process, or you can have a conversation. And then this book, and again, it's almost like the conversation we're having. Your Bullshit is Your Blessing, the subtitle, How to Stop Fixing Yourself and Start Having Fun. It's really that when I was in my thinking, life didn't seem so good. I felt stuck. It was just like, forget it. I'm done. You know, whatever. But then I realized there was another side that was fun, where we were connected. There was love, joy, passion, purpose, all the good stuff. And how can I spend more time over what I call the right side of life? So this book has tools and techniques that I developed over a few years. They really help me. Sometimes I forget about them. I have to read my own book again. But it does take me out of that dark place and get me to the fun side much quicker than if I didn't know about the technique. So that one, again, you can find them all on Amazon. It really, you know, I'm committed to people being free to create lives they love. People being free to create lives they love. And that's why I wrote all of my books. So let's get back to our conversation with Laura, and welcome back. I'm so excited to keep going. So, all right. So tell me if I got this right. When we're unaware, we're in our story, we're in our thinking, nothing wrong with it. That's the way we live. However, there's something else available, which is where's my notes? I can't even describe it right. But there's that conscious, that essence. When we connect to the essence, all of a sudden we're no longer separate. We're connected. There's oneness. There's joy. There's love. Am I saying it right? And then my next question, if I am, is for someone who's never heard of this, or they've thought it was woo-woo or whatever, what would be a first step for them? Because right now, all they know is their thinking, and maybe they're scared to even look. And I'll be quiet.
Well, I think that, you know, if you're listening to this interview, the first thing would just get curious about your own thinking. Start to notice what thoughts you're paying attention to. For example, let's say you're in the kitchen, you're making dinner, and you're looking for the particular knife you need to cut the vegetables, and it's not put in the drawer that it's supposed to be put in. It's put in a different drawer, and you're hunting around. You finally find it, and you notice you're annoyed. When you notice, sometimes noticing our feelings is a little quicker than noticing what our thinking is, but our feelings are the way the body experiences thought. So I'm standing in the kitchen and I'm annoyed because it took me 5 minutes to find this knife. So then I stop and I go, what am I thinking about that? And I'm thinking, well, I'm noticing that my husband put the dishes away and he put them in the wrong place. And so I sort of went off and running about, well, he always puts them in the wrong place. And I told him not to put it in. He knows where the knife. And then I can start to see it's what I make it mean that the knife is in the wrong place has me living out of this whole story I'm in my head, which is instantaneous, I might add, because I have evidence that my husband doesn't put the dish away. You know, we're genius at making people wrong. But if I'm interested in my own, in how to get into this, I start to notice my own thinking. Or let's say, we were at this course that we did together back east, and we went to Tanglewood, and we heard them rehearsing Beethoven's Ninth. And when that chorale came out and started singing Ode to Joy, I was beside myself with tears. It was what I would call a peak experience. So what I notice when I'm looking back at that moment, I was not thinking about anything. I was completely transported by this music that was celestial. So here's that experience when I'm not thinking. And here's this other experience that's pretty small that has me be disgruntled. And, you know, God forbid he walked into the kitchen at that moment, because he's an extraordinary man. I love this guy. But I reduce him to being, you know, looking for a way to be right about something. So I can then see in those two examples, well, that's really interesting. I wonder where else that's happening. Like, what am I thinking when I'm working out? I really enjoy working out. Or even in an interview like this, you know, I can't really prepare how to answer your questions. I have to be able to be in the moment and let whatever wisdom is there, whatever information is there to what you're asking me, come through. Otherwise, this would be a very stilted conversation. I'd be reading my notes and we would have lost the whole audience by now. So, and then I may be interested in what's happening when I'm holding my granddaughter. Because there's just joy is present. So you just start getting curious about noticing what thinking you're paying attention to. Is that helpful? Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I would also say...
And by the way, just to plug my book, I go in detail sort of step by step how to actually do this. I wrote... On the Inward Outlook, both books are available, by the way.
The Inward Outlook,
Conscious Choice as a Daily Practice, is a book written based on the work that I've done over 30 years with thousands of people from all walks of life. I've worked with kids. I've worked with, people who are addicted. I've worked with the chronically mentally ill. I've worked with professionals. I've worked with the public. It's kind of the book points to how human beings are actually physically designed. Human beings are, in spite of our gender, our culture, our whatever generation we were born in, we're all designed the same. And when we start to get curious and interested about how it's kind of like knowing how your car works. I mean, if your car is a gasoline car and you decide to put honey in there instead of gasoline, it's not going to go well. And if you have an electric car and you try and put gasoline in it, you're not going to go anywhere. So it's like the kind of machinery of being a human that's talked about. And you want to get really savvy about how you operate. It's kind of fascinating, actually.
Yeah. So
the book will really walk you through that with exercise. You know, is Chosen is more about the spiritual underpinnings of my work. It's less intellectual. It's less academic. I wrote it so that you could open to a page and you could, you know, read one line. And so here, I just opened to the chapter on fear. And the page is three sentences. It is well known that fear is strong. Only love is stronger than fear. This is a universal truth. So this points to the fact, because I've studied spiritual principle for 45 years, that there's two energies in the universe. One is fear and one is love, and love is the greater. And what we're seeing on the planet right now and on all our media, which has people gripped, is fear. Hmm. And fear seems like it's bigger than love because it's so loud. Mm-hmm. Love is very quiet, but love is more powerful. So
on this page, I just want to tell you what I turned to. There's just four words on this page. It says, love sees only love.
Yeah.
And what I heard, it was a Marianne Williamson thing a long time ago. You can't have fear and love. So if I can remember that when I'm afraid, and if I watch the news, I get immediately afraid because that's what they're trying to do. I remember, well, when I remember, when I can see my thoughts and not be my thoughts, I can say, oh, I choose love. You know, I can choose love. But it takes something. It takes something to pull my head out of that. Oh my God, if this person wins or if this person wins, you know, we're all screwed or whatever. Like,
it's interesting because the way a lot of the media presents is very alarming. So it isn't just the information they're telling, it's the way they're saying it. And that points to what's available in being able to access the moment of now and what's available in the moment of now, which is love, which is peace, peace of mind, well-being. It's actually true power. So you can watch the news if you take a moment to align yourself with that flow of it being in the moment, which connects you to universal thought, which is compassion, joy, peace, and then watch the news. You can actually listen to what's happening without getting triggered by what's happening.
Really?
I notice that when I start to get triggered, it's time to turn off the news.
Yeah. See, sometimes I don't even, you know, it's like, oh, and then all of a sudden, you know, I'm afraid. And it's like, I don't even, I mean, if that's their purpose, and I think that is their purpose because somehow people, like, they get addicted to it, you know, and you have to see more. Well, now, oh my God, what's going to happen? I got to see what's happening. It's like I don't know. It's like an addiction almost.
It is like, you know? It is.
I'm better off not watching it, but sometimes I get sucked in, but then I notice this fear and I'm like, it's not helping me. It's not helping me access my essence to go there. You know, I could be strong enough, but I'm not practiced enough to resist it, I think. And I'm just better off when I don't see it at all. I'm calm. I'm peaceful.
Yes. Well, that tells you something about your thinking, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That you're not thinking about it. And so you're more present in your life.
Yeah.
And it is a practice, but it's practice worth doing.
And which one? Just noticing the thoughts or practicing love?
Practicing in moments when nothing is happening that's concerning. Practice being quiet and still. You can practice it while you're doing, you know, household chores or driving your car. Just be really present with what you're doing with no attention on thinking.
Mm.
And then you will automatically be aligned with that eternal source of wisdom and well-being. And the more you practice that, you know, it's like standing at the elevator. Instead of waiting because the elevator's late, just take the opportunity to be still with yourself.
And how do you do that? I mean, because sometimes when I'm trying not to think, I think worse. What, like...
Don't try not to think. You take your attention off your thinking. Just clear your head. It's just, you could, you. Everyone has to kind of find their own way. But you might be able to say, well, I'm going to listen to the silence. Mm. Listen to the silence in spite of what's going on around you. Listen for the silence.
Mm.
Then you won't be having, you won't be paying attention to thinking about something.
Right.
You'll be listening for the quietness, which actually is quite alive and vibrant and scintillating. Another thing you can do is you could sort of tune into your body and notice the sort of deeply tune into your body and notice sort of the, if you feel some sort of tingling or resonance in your hands or in your legs or in your chest. You know, so you take your attention into your body, which takes your attention off thinking about stuff.
Hmm. Sometimes I do that if I have pain and then I get into this whole story about my pain and la, la, la. And then I'm just like, okay, where is the pain? And if I can notice where it is and, you know, it's like, okay, it's right there. But look at the whole rest of the body has none. And it's not even consistent. And then it gets me out of the story. That's one trick I've learned, you know, because when I'm in my story, oh my God, you know, it's a whole story. But then when I actually can pinpoint it, it's just a little pain, you know?
Well, and that's great. And then another thing is you actually can just really go with the pain, be with actually the pain. And it will often disappear, the experience of pain. We have, even the word pain has a whole story to it.
Mm.
Yeah. Rather than just having it be with the body, you know, I don't know if you have any pets, but we have a dog. First of all, if you look in your dog's eyes and just be with your dog, you'll clear your head because that's where the dog lives, by the way. That's why they're so great to be with. All they see is joy. Like they, you know, you walk in the house, it's like they haven't seen you in 30 years.
Yeah.
And, And just, it's a practice of just forgetting your life, get amnesia about your life.
Mm.
Forget who you are for a while.
That's great.
You know, who we really are these eternal beings disguised as a person.
Mm.
So get curious about who you are bigger than your identity, who you know yourself to be. And start thinking, you know, I'm not limited to who I know myself to be.
Mm. Wow. Well, you know, we have 2 minutes to wrap up, believe it or not. What would you like to say? I think you just did. I think those last two sentences were, you know, wonderful. What message would you like to leave people with? You know, what's your vision of the world? What would you like to say in a minute and a half?
We're at a very challenging time in human history right now. And there's a huge breakdown in the way things have been for a very long time because we're transmuting the way we've been into a new expression of the possibility for human, which is being, not just identifying with human, but accessing being. Who are you being in the world? And the old system isn't going to go down without a fight. So we're seeing extreme attachment to the old ways of operating. And what is in the process of emerging is a new way of operating for humanity to start to see that consciousness is available to us. We're waking up out of an unconscious state and waking up into the consciousness of the essence of who we are, that we're much more than these persons that we know ourselves to be. And the books point to that. The books will help you get more clear about that if that's something you're interested in. And you can get them on my website or on Amazon. And the other thing I would say that might be helpful to people, I designed my website so that people who maybe were feeling hopeless in the world, I wrote the books for this too, could see some possibility where they weren't seeing it before. So the website is whitebirdrising.com. And it's mostly my writings and some artwork that's available to you, but it's mostly a gift to leave for people to see hopefulness and possibility and beauty.
Mm. Well, thank you so much, Laura. This has been very great. Just great. Just love it. I love the conversation. I love, you know, what you're making available for people. So keep going and don't stop. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right. Bye, everyone. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.